You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 143. The way I see it, if you want the rainbow, you're going to have to put up with the rain. Dolly Parton.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Guys, welcome to the show. Before we get started today, I want to let you know that I am actively working on a big update to the Bulletproof Screenwriting website. I just did a huge update for indiefilmhustle.com if you want to go check that out. Redesigned it from the ground up, added a bunch of new stuff, including free classes from Oscar-winning and Emmy-winning and nominated screenwriters that you could take for free if you head over to indiefilmhustle.com and check that out. But we will be doing a big update on Bulletproof Screenwriting. I'm working on it as we speak, so it'll hopefully be out in the next few weeks, and I will definitely let you know when it's ready. Now, today on the show, we have Brooks Elms. Now, Brooks is a very interesting guy because he's a screenwriter, he's a director, he's written 25 plus screenplays, dozen of them on assignment. He's a script doctor, but in many ways, he's the screenwriter whisperer. That's what I like to call him, because he helps not only screenwriters, but filmmakers get back in touch with their creative flow, which is that zone, that place that we all as creatives strive to get to. And we get to it every once in a while. Some filmmakers and screenwriters live there, like Eric Roth, for God's sakes, and so many, Aaron Sorkin and Quentin Tarantino and so many other screenwriters and filmmakers that I can list off here who just kind of like stay there, are able to tap into it every single time they are doing work for decades. But most of us only get in there occasionally. And what Brooks does is he helps you find how you can get in there and tap in there and stay within that world when you're creating. It was a really fascinating conversation, and I think it's going to be very instructive to all the members of the tribe. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Brooks Elms. I'd like to welcome to the show Brooks Elms. How you doing, Brooks?
I'm great. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much for being on the show, man. I truly appreciate it. Yeah, you reached out to me a little while ago. I think you heard me that I was going to write a screenplay. And you're like, hey, if you need any help, man, I'll coach you through it. I'll do that. I was like, and I appreciate that, by the way. Thank you so much. I don't even know when I'm going to start writing this thing, but I'll let you know.
Yeah. Well, it was one of the many things that interests me about you, because you got on my radar like maybe 10 years ago through a mutual friend, Scott, who did this podcast, Film Trooper.
Of course.
And
Scott, yeah, friend of the show. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome. And it was funny because he kept going, oh, yeah, there's this guy, Alex Ferrari. I'm like, who is this guy? I was like all jealous. Like, who is this guy? Who is this Alex guy? I looked you up and I'm like, man, this guy's bringing it, you know? And so I've watched how, like, you know, you always helping indie filmmakers, and then it's just kind of snowballing. So, like, now you're like the Amazon of helping indie filmmakers. It's amazing.
That's awesome. I might steal that. The Amazon of helping filmmakers.
You're welcome. You're welcome to it. I actually, you can use that one. I came up with the tagline for the blacklist.com where screenwriters meet filmmakers or something like that. They sent out their beta and they had some terrible, you know, line. I was like, this is awful. Here, you should do something like this, blah, blah, blah. And they go, oh, that's great. We're going to use it. So you're welcome to it.
Awesome.
I do marketing stuff too. So it comes naturally.
So how did you get started in the business, man?
Oh, man, I started making movies with my friends back in high school, and it was just so much fun. I was like 15 years old, and my noise back there. I got started. I was 15 years old, and my friends came up and said, hey, we're making a kung fu movie. You want to do it? I was like, oh, hell yeah, that sounds great. So we made that movie, and then we made another one. We showed our friends, and they were laughing their asses off, and I was like, oh, my God, I was so completely and utterly hooked. And that was in high school, and I probably made 50 short film experiments before I even got to NYU film school, just because it was intoxicating. I mean, I loved it. You know how that is. So,
the disease, as I call it, the disease. Yeah, yes. You get bitten by the bug and you can't get rid of it. It's done. It's with you for life.
It is. Yeah, I consider myself a recovering independent filmmaker now.
I'm recovering. Oh, I love that one too. Crazy. I'm a recovering independent filmmaker. It is.
I'm always recovering.
Yeah. We're always constantly recovering, and then, of course, we fall off the wagon, because we go and see we watch a Kubrick film or we watch a Nolan film, and you're like, oh, God, I gotta go back and gotta make another movie. We're very weird creatures, filmmakers and screenwriters. It's very strange in the world of all creatives. Because it's just such a – I don't think there's many other forms. Screenwriters are different, but filmmakers need a team, need to gather the troops, need to get the carnies together to put the tent up, to put on the show.
Sure.
It is unlike any other art form. Not a writer, not a painter. Even a musician could do something alone if they want to. They could be a singer-songwriter and do their own thing. For us, it's just weird. We got to convince other people to jump on a crazy train with us. As an independent,
there was a moment. So after I graduated NYU film school, that summer I made my first feature, and it was based loosely on the I played on the NYU soccer team, and the movie was about how our team was like perfectly average. They weren't a great team. They weren't a terrible team. We were really good at drinking after games, right? So I made this movie that was okay about the soccer team, and I was 4 or 5 days into the shoot, and we were doing these soccer sequences. So there was like 30, 40 people on set. I'm 22 years old, don't really know what the hell I'm doing, but I went around and I looked around. And I was like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. That I guess it's like, you know, that love for movies and then the love for creation kind of come together when you're directing.
Yeah, when you're on set, I love being on set. Set is one of my favorite places to be, and we get to do it so rarely, you know, unless you're Ridley Scott, who's working 24/7 every day, and he's on set every week. It's tough because as an artist, you only get to actually do your art a handful of times, really, unless you're doing commercials or doing something else. But like as a feature director, if you're lucky once a year, and that's an insanity. If not, you're working every couple years, if you're lucky, as getting a project off the ground, getting the financing. It's a weird art form. And then you're depressed the rest of the time. is it like you when you go off set and it's the last day of shoot, I'm like depressed. Like I'm going into post, so it gives me something to look forward to. But when on the day of, I'm like, this is family. These carnies are my family I've been with for a few weeks now. And it's like this whole... we're such weird creatures.
it's intense. It's absolutely intense because it's such a hurricane of intention and hope and dedication and awesomeness. And then it just goes, boom, there's a void when it's done.
It's And then after post, it's worse. Yeah, now you're just like, oh, I got nothing to do now except like hope the distributor's going to send me a check.
Well, I actually love the marketing side. Even when – so that film that I made when I was 22, when we finally finished it, I took it on like a college tour on the East Coast.
Good for you.
It was so much fun. I did that. We showed it – because it was a college-y movie. And I showed it at a bunch of different colleges along the East Coast, and we did like a month-long screening event in an off Broadway space in New York that I called the New York City Guerrilla Cinema. So from the jump, I've always loved the marketing and promotion side as much as I love the creation side.
As I do, as you know, as I do, I love the marketing and promotion side. It gets me jazzed up big time. Now you work with a lot of screenwriters, and you know you consult and you coach and you help screenwriters break through their own crap, as we all have our own walls we have to grow through. Why do most screenplays fail, in your opinion?
Because they, we have to define how they fail, right? There's failing for
story.
My own, yeah.
Story.
Well, so ultimately, like because let's take off the subjectivity, right? Because what might be a failure for me might be my favorite or vice versa, right? So taking that apart. So let's say it's not even by the writer's own standards, it actually didn't hit the mark. Generally, you're talking about it's hero goal conflict. The hero probably wasn't as defined as it could be. The goal probably wasn't as compelling as it could be. And then the stakes, the conflict wasn't quite right.
Now, when you start writing, do you write with starting with character or with plot?
Neither. I start with concept, basically.
Concept would be more plot-esque, I guess. Kind of.
If I had to squeeze one, I don't know. I think concept kind of bridges them both, right?
Right.
Because a great concept will have people kind of, you know, you can say it in a sentence and it'll sort of crack open people's mind. They'll go, oh, A, that sound, I get it. I get a lot of the stuff that's happening there and it's really compelling. Oftentimes there's a bit of an irony in there that helps you sort of unlock that sort of magic. And you can do great work, especially if you're a good director or you have a good director do your stuff with a sort of not a great concept, right? But like when you start with a great concept, everything else gets easier because of that quality of the foundation.
So talk to me about theme, because I think that's also another place where a lot of screenplays and stories fail is they have no compass, and the theme is that compass, and they you see it all the time. I mean, you watch some of these movies and you're just like, there's no theme here. There's just like, oh look, there's a bunch of people fighting or there's a bunch of action or scares. But like when you study like a horror movie specifically, you study Halloween, you study, you know, Exorcist. Mm-hmm. The storytelling is so solid that the scares are just bonus, as opposed to films that just focus on the scares and not the thing. And there's that theme underneath it that really is the backbone. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So theme is tricky because it's a gravitational center point, and yet it's kind of ephemeral. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If we kind of hold it too hard, it kind of slips through our fingers and it gets more confusing, right? One helpful way that feels kind of concrete with theme, because for me, theme is like, you know, crime pays or crime doesn't pay, or right. Love conquers all, or you know, we'll talk about Shawshank at some time, which is hope versus despair, right? But like a very sort of grounded, concrete way of thinking about it is really sort of your character's misbehavior and then their behavior. So they start out here with some sort of obstacle and problem, and they're doing it the wrong way, right? And this is an expression of our own life. Like we all have life challenges, and when we're in the more human side of ourselves, we're not meeting our challenge well. We're running away from something, we're cowardly, we're gluttonous, or we're doing something, some sort of misbehavior. And our screenplays are a metaphor for this real thing going on in us, if they're really great. It's some sort of metaphor for something we did, and we did it kind of the wrong way, and the script is about how we learn to do it the right way through painful trial and error. Your theme is a word that kind of speaks to that transformation. So in particular, with your idea of shooting for the mob, right? Mm-hmm. When you were talking, I was watching your awesome episode 501.
Yeah, with RB.
And I was listening to it, and I was like, oh, it's interesting. So because my understanding of where you're at is it's like, you know, you've written the book and at some point you want to do it and maybe even have some great screenwriters that might be helpful, but you're kind of like, I'm not sure kind of where to start. To my mind, because that's sort of like my specialty, is I take a writer and I clarify their superpower, and then I walk with them step by step on how to completely powerfully realize it. And what's exciting to me about at least where you are with your stories, your theme is already so night and clear. It's like it's about and I haven't read the book. I'm just basically on the concept. It's about an independent filmmaker that is so, you know, urgent to make his movie that he ends up doing it the wrong way, getting in bed with the wrong people, and then realizing he can't do that, right? So that, it to me, thematically, you're in a really good place. And a lot of times, especially independent filmmakers, they don't have a theme that's so clean and simple. So to my mind, structuring your story, even again, having read the book, I'm sure it's probably pretty good because I know you and I know what you're doing, but like just based on a conceptual thing, what's going to make a good film, I can already see potential for how you could structure that thematically and really powerfully, just because your theme is so good.
Well, I appreciate that. That for me is a tough conversation, just because it took me so long to get the courage to just even write the book, and the emotions that were attached to that story, and you know, it was real life, and I literally, you know, was crying through some chapters as I wrote it, because I was like going back to the darkest times of my life, but I felt it needed to get out there to help other filmmakers and other, not only filmmakers, anybody in a tough situation that they think they can't get out of, but they can. But for me, it's just tough to even think about starting to write it again, going back to that place mentally, going back to that world. I don't mind directing it, and that's actually what it's a precondition of anybody who wants to make the movie with me, is that I have to direct, and my DP has to be the DP, because he was Boris in the movie, and that was in the book, and that's it. Those are the only two. That's it. That's all I need. But I don't know. I think I might be too close to it. But I'll figure that out next year when I begin that process.
I could help you out offline just really quickly in terms of how to, because the stuff I started doing first, I won a screenplay award at NYU doing this very personal senior thesis film, right? And it was about how the previous summer I brought my girlfriend home to my hometown, and like she and my best friend didn't get along. So it was a very personal film about my best friend. I had to choose between my best friend and my girlfriend, right? And it was very raw because it had just happened. And then the first feature I made was about my friends on the soccer team and how I was frustrated with the coach and blah, blah, blah. So, and then when I broke through to the next level and started really selling scripts, I was able to take my superpower as a guy that could write grounded characters and tension, and then put it into a genre that was just more accessible. It was like, I wrote this alien invasion movie that was very gritty and grounded, and it felt like a shooter event or a terrorist attack, but it just kept unfolding from there into being this alien invasion, and it did really well. So anyway, and I work with writers who are working with all sorts of deep personal issues. So one of my specialties is figuring out how to, because we have to, coming from that personal place is exactly what's going to make that movie really great, Alex. And yet you're right. If you're too close to it, it just triggers too much stuff because you lived it and you wrote about it already.
And it's tough to make a movie, because a book is one thing, but to make a movie, it has to change. Characters are going to be added, story lines and plots are going to be added that have to be there to make it into a movie, or else. Right. And that's the thing that it's hard for me to even comprehend. I'm like, well, that's not the way it happened. And even if on a conscious level I say no, I'm going to let that go, on a subconscious level it's going to rear its ugly head. So it's tough.
And here's how I would advise you or somebody in that situation, right? Because it happens a lot. The key is that will unlock it is thinking of it as the same but different of something else. So for example, the last script that I sold. It's a father and son story, and I basically ripped off the form of Kramer versus Kramer, right? So Kramer versus Kramer, Dustin Hoffman, 1980, is a workaholic ad man, last guy that is actually a good father. Meryl Streep, having a nervous breakdown, takes off and goes, you gotta watch our kid. He's like, what the, you know? So he has to learn painfully how to be a dad, and then at midpoint, she's like, okay, I've had my breakdown, I want to come back and take custody. He goes, whoa. Now I like being a dad. So then it's them fighting, right? So I took that basic pattern, right? And I swapped out everything, all the characters, all the settings.
Yeah.
And I wrote this script called The Art of the Knockout that's going into production next year. And it's about this bare-knuckle brawler that travels around the circus in the 1920s. He fathered this kid 8 years ago that I didn't even know about. That kid's mom dies, and they stick him. And so the last guy that should be a dad, this bare-knuckle brawler, is stuck watching this kid. He hates it. He tries to get rid of the kid. It's awful. And then slowly learns to actually really love being a father, and then has to fight to keep him at the end, right? So it's the same but different. And when that got set up and I was getting notes, none of the notes were on the structure. Structure, perfect. The only notes were they had a couple ideas on how to raise the stakes and this and that. So my invitation to you or anybody like you that has something based on personal experience, see if it'll help you to sort of differentiate it from what actually happened and thinking of it as a movie. And if once you think of it as a movie, and it doesn't have to be the same genre. Oh, it's kind of like such and such or this or that. And then once you think of it as that, and then you use what actually happened in the book about it as a buffet of elements to serve the vehicle of the story, now you're just making it more accessible. Now, you might not want to do all that stuff. You know, it's independent filmmaking. We could do whatever the hell we want, right? So you got to do it the way you want, most importantly. And if you want to lean into what Hollywood does best in terms of concept and structure, that would be my invitation. Find a form of a story that you can kind of use. Because here's the other thing that happens, Alex. I liken it to people that put like a triangle wheel on a car, right? Really creative, but that car's not going to go anywhere, right? Because it's not going to run. So what I say is don't be creative. Round wheels. Big wheels, small wheels, fine, but round wheels. And then once we know it goes, then get creative. And so for me, for you, I think the most accessible and powerful version of what actually happened and sort of vision would probably be something like that. Pick a movie that you love and that has and get the round wheels from that and then swap it out and make it completely personal to you. And to me, that's a way of being completely 100% authentic to that theme and the feelings, because that's what we really care about. But the actual move, the story that comes out, you know, is some things exactly what happened and some things that are just there to serve the new truth of your metaphor. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes all the sense in the world. You said something that was really interesting, and I think it's a lesson that we can we pass on to the listeners, is the you took Kramer versus Kramer structure and swapped it out. There's so many screenwriters, working screenwriters, who do that all the time, that they'll take a movie, their favorite movie, and they'll swap out the theme, they'll swap out the conversation, they swap out everything, characters. It's not like they're stealing anything.
That's
sometimes
right.
Sometimes
right.
It is, and I'm going to give you an example of what it was. But you can use that structure because that hard work has been laid out. It's kind of like already having a blueprint. And you're putting up new walls, you're dressing it differently, you're putting new finishes on, but it's the structure that's been sound and it works already and it's been proven to work. And that's something that a lot, especially, it's also a good starting point too. If you start looking at a movie and you break down their scenes and you're like, okay, I'm going to replace this scene with this scene and this scene with this scene, and I'm just going to literally copy the blueprint of that, that's a good starting point to get the juices flowing. And it could shift a bit as you go. It's not going to be exact, but the basic foundation is the same. And I found that to be really, really valuable. I always look at movies like, what movie do I want this to be at? Like, and it doesn't have to be the same genre. It could be completely different. Perfect Sure. example of a movie that we all know that started one of the biggest franchises in the world, Point Break. Point Break, wonderful Huh? film. Love it. One of the best action movies of the 90s. Keanu Reeves in all of his glory. Patrick Swayze in all of his glory. It is basically, it was stolen 100% is Fast and Furious. The first Fast and Furious is Point Break. If you look at it and analyze it, Fast and Furious 1 is they just switched out surfers for cars. That was the only difference. It's the only difference in the movie.
Same but different.
It's the exact same movie. It's like, it's not surfers, and it's the same thing, and then he falls.
Another interesting example of that, in the script that I just finished now, I was using the model of Dead Poets Society. A mentor comes in, gets really overly influenced, it goes to a tragic place, but then they still celebrate the mentor at the end, right? And I was telling people when I was getting notes, I go, yeah, this is kind of like Dead Poets Society, whatever. And people would read it and go, this is nothing like Dead Poets Society. What the hell are you talking about? So I had been so creative past where the round, and I knew as a screenwriter, no, it was exactly that pattern. Those were the exact same round wheels, but they couldn't tell because I made it 100% authentic to me and my characters, despite the fact that it had a rock solid foundation. So that's, I think, the key for you is that if you find a way of telling an aspect of what happened that feels like really beautifully in harmony with one of your favorite movies sort of patterns, dude, that to me, I could see you just amazingly telling that story in a really powerful way.
I appreciate that. We'll see. I got a couple things I got to do this year.
And the broader thing for everybody is like anybody who's doing memoir, right? Something that's starting from a really personal place. It's tricky if we're too close to it, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a game of getting a real healthy distance. It's great that you're writing what you know because it's going to resonate with authenticity. The game is to put it in a package that's more accessible to more people, depending on whatever audience size you want to serve. It's fine to do something obscure if that's really where your heart is. But if you want to do something that's really bigger and breaks through with a bigger audience, they're looking for a cleaner foundational package. And you can do that just by sort of, you know, understanding how the same but different works in terms of concept.
Now, you mentioned Shawshank, which everyone listening to the show knows my love for Shawshank. And anytime we get to talk about Shawshank and analyzing and breaking it down, I think it's a benefit to every listener. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Shawshank and what Shawshank can teach us as writers, as storytellers, and the brilliance of what Frank Darabont did with a short story from Stephen King, arguably still the worst title in movie history, Shawshank Redemption. It's absolutely horrendous title for marketing. I love the title, and it makes all the sense in the world. But try to market that movie, and they couldn't.
It's brutal. Terrible marketing decision.
But what do you call it, though? But let me ask you, what do you call it? If you can't call it, it's a redemption movie, but what do you call it?
No, it's about hope. You basically not, and obviously not like hope this or hope that, but like something that evokes hope. I would love to brainstorm a really good title for that because I guarantee you. Well, look, you can't do worse than that title, right? So
it's pretty bottom. It's like one of the worst titles. I still remember it was nominated for Best Picture, didn't win anything. I think it was nominated for Best Screenplay. I think it had to be nominated for Best Screenwriting. It might have been.
It might have been. I think
he got like three or four Oscar nominations, like some acting.
Yeah, I think it. And its initial release, I don't think it did very well. I think it didn't bomb, but it kind of just limped along. And then it got some awards, and it got another bump. But then it really picked up, I think, in
home video.
Home viewing afterwards, yeah,
home video, and then it then became number one on IMDb. It beat The Godfather as the best movie of most beloved movie of all time.
That's right. That's right. So, so here's my thoughts on the number one takeaway for anybody listening, because I know these were all fellow storytellers, is if you happen to like the movie, or especially if you love it, the best takeaway is really theme, because the way they talk about hope versus despair is so beautiful and so powerful and so clean and simple. Again, a lot of times with theme, it gets heady. It's really hard to kind of track. But with Shawshank, it's so damn clear and compelling, but not like batting you over the head with it, but really easy to track. So, and what you have is a really interesting dynamic of the way it's structured. So you have Red, played by Morgan Freeman, who I would characterize as actually the protagonist, even though Tim Robbins, Andy Dufresne is driving the narrative. So that's unusual. Usually, almost always our protagonist drives the narrative. But in this case, I would call Red the protagonist because he changes in the end. He goes from despair. Look, you can't use hope in this place. Hope will get you killed. You have to despair. You have to be cynical about life. And then slowly he sees Andy like an effing freight train getting beat up and raped and all these terrible things happen over and over again. And he's a freight train of hope and hope and hope and hope and hope and digs himself out and breaks out of prison with like a little rock hammer for like 10 years. I mean, that's the most magnificent expression of hope you could possibly believe. And he finally makes it out. And I think it's such a triumphant expression of hope over despair. And we all feel both of them. But to me, thematically, it's so powerfully laid out. And I think that's why it resonates so deeply. Plus, there's some charm in those characters. There's a warmth between that friendship between those two guys. Oh. But thematically, it's a great model to study if you're confused about theme or this or that.
The thing that's so fascinating about Shawshank for me is that on paper, it's a horrible pitch. It's a horrible, you see the trailer, you're just like, it's about a prison. It's a prison movie. It's like, it does only once you experience it, do you understand the depth of it. And I remember seeing that it was 94.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I think it was came out in 94. So I had just gotten out of high school a few years, and I was with a bunch of knucklehead friends of mine who were not moviegoers, and they were touched. And when those guys were touched, yeah, I was like, wow, this cut through everything. At that time, I even felt it when I saw it in the theater. I was just like, wow, this is a different kind of film. And
Hollywood calling.
Yeah, it was a very different kind of film. And I always, my analysis of the film has always been like, why? I always ask the same question: why does it connect? Because we could all just pray for a connection with an audience like Shawshank has, and like, what is it about that film? Because it's not obvious. It's not like Rocky. We get why people connect with Rocky. We connect why people connect with Indiana Jones or Star Wars. We get it. But Shawshank is so under the radar on the surface. You can't. What do you think?
You're going to love this answer because it's clear as day to me why it connects. And you can use that for your own story. It's because we feel despair. And the despair that I feel in my life as a, coddled white male in the richest country ever, is still hurts and is scary to me. And when I see a depiction of it like that, like, the guy's in prison and the people are coming after him and his physical safety is there, and he was wrongly imprisoned and all these things, all these terrible things. And if that guy can have hope in that place, holy crap. And then have it pay off by him actually getting out because that hope paid off after like 15, 20 years he was in. It wasn't like a week. And to me, that speaks so deeply to all of us because we all face oftentimes in a daily basis an aspect, a sort of much lesser aspect, but an aspect of hope versus despair. Should I even get out of bed? You feel despair, you don't want to get out of bed, but you have hope and you climb out or whatever. So, but it's that, to me, it's so universal in our own way, that sense of, do we have hope? Do we have is there an opportunity for something to happen? And so, like, for your story about this guy who has this urgent hope that this movie is going to get made, and he's got this beautiful dream, and then he's in this despairing place where he's getting involved with these people that are difficult. So it's, to me, what you love about Shawshank, you can bring out cinematically in what you love about your own movie. And in fact, when I work with people, that's exactly where I go to. So I have them list their favorite movies and we get into why they love them, why Shawshank speaks so deeply to you. What does that hope versus despair really feel like in your real life? And I haven't even read the book, but I promise you there are things that went on in your real life that you sort of associate with this idea of hope versus despair that you also connect to Shawshank. And then what I do is I connect those things out so that when people write a movie that feel that has the same sort of pattern as Hollywood, but it's authentic in a way that's really deep and personal, that's when it crackles with authenticity. And so, does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I mean, I've said this on the show before, but I think the analogy of Shawshank and Andy Dufresne's journey is what connects with people because you feel. You are Andy Dufresne, and in many ways, many of us in the world, depending on where you live in the world, at one point or another, feel imprisoned.
Yeah.
Feel like the universe is wrongly beating you, attacking you.
That's right.
Bad things are happening to you, and you're innocent.
Yeah.
And you're innocent of these bad things. And then that not only does he have hope to fight through all of that, but he literally crawls through a mile of shit then he literally gets out of that, is cleansed from the gods of the shit. Literally, the shit is coming off of him. He's taking the old clothes off of him, putting on a new suit, living the life that he's been dreaming about for 15 years. And then on top of it all, he gets revenge, the sweetest revenge on his jailers. And he literally lives on a freaking paradise. And that's, but that's why I think it feels so, for me, I mean, let's not get into the psychoanalysis of Alex Ferrari for a second, if anybody cares. For me, when I saw that movie, I didn't feel it as much as I felt it years later, where I hadn't been beat up by the business yet as much. I had been beat up. I think when I saw Shawshank, I hadn't, the thing with the mob hadn't happened to me yet. It was years away. So years later, that movie took another meaning for me because of all the abuse that the business has given me and failures that I've had that I'm like, why is this happening to me? Why can't I get the opportunity? Why can't someone open the door for me? Why can't I have my pickaxe and to knock into some doors? And I felt imprisoned in my own. So there was a lot of that going on. And I think that's one of those things that when people watch it, they identify with.
So and that's exactly it, right? So the metaphor of being in prison and even getting to the end and crawling through the shit and all that stuff is a really good metaphor for how so many people feel about their life, how we psychologically process our life. Mm-hmm. And so when you do that, your own version of that, which is really great because like most people don't experience prison, most people don't experience a run-in with the mob. So it's a really beautiful, exaggerated metaphor for most people. Plus, you've got this hero with this beautiful, innocent, sweet dream. He wants to be a filmmaker, right? So it's you know, the key is in sort of the takeaway I would invite for you to take it is that it's just look at how much every scene there's conflict and conflict and conflict and conflict. So that allows us to feel like it's earned so much when he comes. A lot of scripts, you talked about what some main things that sort of trip people up in terms of a great screenplay. A lot of times the conflict isn't strong enough. They take it a little too easy on me, especially in Act 2B. When things, that's when, like Blake Snyder would say, things are, this is when bad guys close in, things can get much harder. A lot of screenwriters take their foot off the gas and we feel bad because we love our hero and it's hard for them. But no, we need to burn their house down. We need to, because the more we torture them in Act 2B, the more powerfully they can rise from the ashes in Act 3 and be the hero they were meant to be.
Without a good villain, you don't have conflict. Without a good villain, you can't have a hero be a hero. And that is as simple as that. And the balance is not to make the villain too powerful, that the hero has no chance.
Well, the way I would say it is... make the guy as absolute powerful as you can without losing plausibility, right?
That's
like
the,
me against Godzilla, I'm not going to win, and it's stupid, right?
Right, and that's
King Kong versus Godzilla. Then it's a decent fight, right?
Right, exactly. And you know, you want to make Darth Vader's Darth Vader, you know, and you want Hannibal Lecter to be Hannibal Lecter, but there's a chance, like Apollo versus Rocky. Which is, I mean, that there's not many movies from the 70s that still resonate to this day in the way that they do, you know, like I could show that to a 20-year-old now and they'll be like, yeah, it looks a little dated, but I get it. And the music and all that stuff. But when Apollo and the thing that was so brilliant about Rocky, the first Rocky, is that Rocky didn't have any aspirations to beat Apollo. That was the brilliant move in Stallone's script. He didn't want to beat him. He just wanted to stay with him.
Let me jump in. Two things that I love about that as an example. So two things. One is, one of my favorites is the double refusal of the call. He gets the opportunity to fight the champ, and he goes, no, I'm just a bum. I can't do it, right? And then Mick comes. So he basically says no at first, right? And then Mick comes over and goes, dude, I can train champions. I can train you, you know? And he goes, no, I don't. So the double, because the refusal of a call is always a wonderful moment in Act 1, and they do it twice powerfully. Then to your point, at the end of Act 2, if I remember correctly, once he committed to answer the call and commits, then he's like, okay, I'm going to be the champ. And at the end of Act 2, he's studying the tape over and over again and goes, I can't beat him. He's in that dark night of the soul. It's like, I can't beat that guy. But to your point, if I can go the distance, If I can hold my own, then I have the real win, which is my redemption and my dignity. And that gives me chills just speaking. No, that's what we all want, right?
I mean, it's spawned, what, 8 movies now or something like that? And we're still, every time, we're like, okay, I'm going to watch another one. I'm gonna watch it again. I could watch Rocky 1, 3, 4, both 6, and all the
not
Creeds.
Not a fan of Rocky 2?
I don't mind Rocky 2 as much. I don't mind Rocky 2. But 5 is, we should not discuss 5. 5 is not to be discussed. It just goes right from 4 to Rocky Balboa. That's the way. And that's actually the way he did it, I think. I think even Stallone's like, yeah, I don't know what I was doing back then. But the thing that was, and for everyone listening, if you analyze Rocky, there literally could not be a villain like Apollo. There is absolutely no credible chance that Rocky Balboa should even be in the same room with him, let alone in the ring with him. And as the movie goes on, you start seeing, well, wait a minute, he's cracking ribs of cows. You're giving, he's got a shot now. Can he possibly beat the Titan? It's like it's the mortal going after the Titan. It's insane. It's a wonderful film.
It really is wonderful, and I hadn't thought about it to just the way you said it there. But what's lovely about that construction is, at the beginning, Rocky is such at a low point in his life. He's so severely feeling self-doubt and just hates himself. And it just is. And what is the opposite of that? Apollo Creed, perfect.
Everything.
He's just confident.
Everything.
He's the best.
Rich.
He's the world champion.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful mirror of each other, which is a metaphor for us. And part of us always feels that despair. Part of us feels that power, right? And the movie really beautifully, you know, earns step by step to the point where the part of us that feels despair finds redemption in actually not even beating the world champ, but just holding his own against the champ. It's beautiful.
And I love the way you were saying the analysis of, like, he's the mirror image. So he's the champ. He's perfect. He's got everything. Rocky's got nothing. He's got self-doubt. So they're opposite. They're mirror opposites of each other, which is exactly what a villain and a hero should be, is mirror opposites. But as the movie continues, and this is the brilliance of what Stallone did, the characters start getting closer together thematically. He starts to lose his confidence a bit. He starts to gain it a bit, till at the end of the movie, they're even. Rocky has gone the distance with the champ. The champ is now lost the fight to Rocky, because he allowed a bum, to quote unquote bum, to hold him off and survive against the champ. So when Rocky 2 starts, they're starting on even keel.
Yeah.
That's the brilliant, I mean, it's just such a brilliant way of looking at it. And you look at that now, it's been stolen a million times. I mean, how many times have we seen Rocky? It's like Star Wars.
That's right. That's right. Well, yeah, and if they steal it in the right way, like we've been talking about, the right amount of the same but different, it's amazing. And that's the tricky thing. Like, when I do my own stuff and I work with other people, it's really about dialing in the same amount of the same but different, or the right amount. Because if it's too familiar, then it's like boring. And if it's too different, then it's like weird, right? So you want familiar enough and fresh enough, you know, the same but different.
It's tricky. You see the movie Warrior?
I did. The MMA
fight. I absolutely love Warrior. I think it's a masterwork. It's easily the best MMA movie. And there had been a few other MMA movies, but they're nothing that hooked it. But the thing that was so brilliant about Warrior, and because it's a Rocky, it's kind of a Rocky-esque. And they even mention Rocky in the movie, which is great. Hey, Rocco, you know, are you going to bring Mickey? But the emotion, I remember seeing that in the theater. I was bawling at the end. I was absolutely bawling. My wife and I were sitting there, and I was absolutely just like sniffles, boogers coming out. I was bawling. I connected so well because of the emotional connection with the brothers and the dad. But it was just such a brilliantly constructed story. And then Tom Hardy It was amazing. Sorry, went off on a tangent there. This is great.
You know, my next project is, like, it's a fight film, so I love fight films. Raging Bull is my favorite fight film.
I mean, in Raging Bull, but like, okay, you look at something like Raging Bull and you just go, well, why do I even bother making movies? sometimes you make it, it's like watching, you walk in and you see the Sistine Chapel and you're like, well, I should just drop the brush right now. It's been done. But the thing is, it's not. It's never been done to your what you can bring to the table, and never underestimate that power. Not that you're going to be better, but there's something inside you that Martin Scorsese doesn't have, and vice versa.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Exactly right. One of my favorite stories about Raging Bull is that I heard that when they went to get this thing set up at a studio, you know, De Niro's in there with Marty and they're talking, and you know, the studio exec's like, oh, you know, I don't know this thing. This guy, this character, he's kind of like a cockroach. And De Niro goes, no, he's not. That was it. It was just like, and it was that conviction and that non-judgment of, this is a human being and I'm called to play him. And that, and he's just, he was a force of an actor playing a force of a man. And it was, to me, that was like, yeah, that's why that movie is so good. The guy is really, in a lot of ways, he's a terrible husband, a terrible brother, what makes him amazing in The Ring makes him terrible in his personal relationships, which, you know, is a metaphor that lots of people can do. But like Scorsese and Schrader and De Niro all were so devoted to the authenticity of that character and those relationships that they didn't judge them. And that made it so compelling, because we all have those parts in ourselves that go too far in this way or that way.
Yeah, there's no question. And sometimes you like to wallow in the dark areas of your life, and you rarely wallow in the good. I mean, sometimes you do, but you have to learn. It's a skill.
It, for sure. So that's actually one of the other things I do in my own life, and when I help writers, we practice wallowing in the good stuff, because it makes it more, you know how it's a marathon, right? And it's easier, it's less challenging to run the marathon when we have more good feelings more often. So this flow state. I'm an absolute champion of getting people into the flow state, staying in the flow state as long as possible. When they get bumped out, getting them back in, because A, it feels better, and B, you get better results because it's more sustainable than sort of cynicism.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about that flow state for a minute? Because it's an interesting thing. I've brought this up on multiple shows that I host, because I always find it fascinating when I talk to, you know, some of these, you know, Oscar winning or legendary writers or something like that. And I go, how do you tap into that? Because, you know, like when you're writing Forrest Gump, there's something going on. Like you're tapping into something else. And it's always, there's the one-offs that do that one great script and they never can reach that height again. That's one thing. And they were just able to get in there for a second and then they left. But then there's the people that just hold that career and they just hit boom and boom and boom and boom. And you're just like, how do you continuously connect to that state? And what is that state? And where is that coming from? I was always the bigger, like, who's the man or the woman behind the curtain sending you this information? Because I always feel that as writers, we're just conduits. We're conduits of something coming in. I think Spielberg said this, that he's like, ideas float around the universe and they pop into your head. And if you don't do something about it, someone else will pick it up. And you might get the first crack at it. And that's why he's always so like, was it him? No, it was Prince. Prince, I was talking to somebody who worked with Prince, and Prince would call at 3 o'clock in the morning to his like his singer and like a musician, like, hey, what are you doing? Like, I don't know, Prince, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. What do you need? He's like, do you want to come in and record? I'm like, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Can I wait 4 or 5 hours? He's like, no, if I don't get this, Michael Jackson's going to get it. And I want to record it first.
That's great.
That's a great story, but that's a true story.
It's fascinating that you went to a musician, because the examples that pop into my mind right away are from a few different musicians, because they just hear it. So one of them was Chris Martin in an interview, and they're talking about one of his shows, and you just see it. He goes, it was like he was in a listening state. He just said, I was listening and it came through. It came to me. Paul McCartney was like, one of his best songs. He woke up in the morning, he heard the song in his head, and he was like, oh yeah, who sings this one? Who's this? And he kind of, his friends are like, I don't know, I've never heard that one. He's like, no, this one. Oh, and he realized, oh, nobody, it was me. I don't know. So it's this thing. It's a state of listening, as opposed to like leaning forward. I'm writing my story. It's, I'm listening to the universe in this flow state, and that's when we get to the height of our creativity. Same thing with Bob Dylan. I listened to an old interview with him a couple days ago, and it was like, and the interview was a 60 minutes interview, and he's like, "Yeah, you said you wrote Blowing in the Wind in 10 minutes," and he goes, "Yeah." And it was like, and I was looking at him, and it was the same energy I saw around the other two. Same thing with Prince. He was like, "Well, how'd you do it?" And you just see him. It's almost like he's radio tuning. You just see him going here, and he was like, "Yeah, it just came to me." He opened up in a way, and it came through. And then he also said in the same thing, he's like, "I haven't been able to get to that quite flow state.
That channel again. I can't tune into that channel again."
That's what he said. But to the people that are musicians or filmmakers or whatever that are able to sort of sustain optimal creative flow over decades, they have a repeatable process of getting into that listening mode, a way of sort of opening up and being soft. And you've spoken to all these amazing people, and I'm sure you see there's almost a lightness of energy when you talk to those people that are really hitting on that level. At least when they're doing their thing, it'll open and it'll and then you don't know where the hell you're almost like a stenographer. It's like, "Oh, I didn't even write this. It's coming through me in service to the audience." And so that's one of my, as a coach, it's one of my favorite things to do is make choices in my relationship when I'm listening to somebody to induce that flow state really deeply and as often as possible. And then when they show up on a call and they're having a tough day or whatever, I make choices that kind of just nudge them slightly up or give them really hold space. I listen to them and let them unfold into that flow state so that they optimize their creativity. I love it.
It's amazing. I've actually felt that in editing. I've done that a lot. Like, you feel the flow of the cuts and you just, and then all of a sudden you're like, "I've been sitting here for 6 hours."
That's how you know. Yeah.
But with my two books that I've written, both of them, I'll go back to and I'm like, "Who wrote this?" Because it's just channeled through me. It really, I mean, yes, I obviously Shooting for the Mom is my story, but the words of putting the story together, I would just write and then I would go back and read it. I'm like, "Who wrote this?" Like, I see, same thing with Rise of the Film Entrepreneur, which is actually a nonfiction book, instructional book. Even then, I'm like, the concepts and stuff, I know all of them, but I'm like, who? I don't remember writing that. I don't remember writing this. Like, who wrote this? Like, this is good.
so here's a really interesting thing. So one of the things I did about Shawshank, Shawshank Redemption, I made this video about how you can read Shawshank Redemption as a law of attraction story, right? So law of attraction is this idea that you basically, however you show up, you will attract. You know, the energy of how you show up. So if you show up feeling successful, you attract success in general, right? That's a lot of other parts to it. But I did a video where I was showing you sort of walking through Shawshank with that lens of law of attraction. So instead of hope versus despair, it was sort of attracting versus sort of repelling. But it's significant in this context because because some of those law of attraction people that when they're talking, they actually say they're channeling and they're saying it's coming from, some people say aliens or some people say spirits, right? And look, they might be. I don't have that personal experience.
Sure.
But from my perspective, exactly what you said, it's like you felt like it almost wasn't coming from you. And so when some of those law of attraction people talk about it, they believe literally it's not coming from them. And who cares? Because it puts them in a state of them being able to say, "I'm spreading more joy. I'm helping people better. I'm coming up with really deep, powerful ideas more often, more consistently." So to my mind, I don't give a crap how you're talking about it, whether it's aliens or spirits or just like you or I see it as just sort of the muse or creativity and it comes through. If you're getting to those really beautiful, powerful ideas in a flow state, great. That's what matters.
Yeah, and I'm always fascinated about where creativity comes from. You know, I've been fascinated by, that's why I love asking some of these heavy hitters that come on the show of like, how do you do it? Like, where does it come from? And I was interviewing on another show, Bruce Dickinson, the lead singer of Iron Maiden.
Wow, cool.
And what a great conversation that was. And when I was talking to him, I asked him, I'm like, "Man, what does it feel like being in Wembley Stadium with 90,000 people?" I'm never going to get that. I don't think anytime soon 90,000 people are going to show up to hear me talk. So maybe one day, I don't know, but that's not happening right now. So not many of us are ever going to feel that. I'm like, what does that feel like? And then when you're singing, where does that come from? Because it's one thing to sing, and then there's another thing to perform at a level like that, regardless if you like his music or not, is irrelevant. Yeah. Irrelevant. And he's like, he goes, oh, it's not me. It just comes through me. I'm in a complete, I don't even know where I'm at when I'm on stage almost. So it's flying through me. And then I go, well, how do you get off that train? Like when you're on it, he's like, oh, I have a whole routine after the show. Because the high of 90,000 people, that energy coming towards you. Like as screenwriters and filmmakers, we don't get that. The closest we get to that is that audience in a movie theater or at a festival. That's the closest we get to it. And
that's really intense.
It's really? Oh God, if you have I've been in that room when the standing ovations and people asking you questions and all that attention and all that stuff.
It's a really hot, explosive energy. Yeah,
it is. So I'm like, but can you imagine 90,000? Like Paul McCartney. Like if I ever got a chance to talk to Paul, I'm like, how? Like how? Is it, how do you live as Paul McCartney? Like, how, you know, being the most famous human being on the planet.
Here's a great little Paul. If you look at the clip of when he was doing carpool karaoke with who's that guy that does it?
James Gordon.
Yeah. There's a really beautiful exchange, and it speaks to this idea of that lightness of energy, where they're talking, and he's going, oh, wow, you know, this is amazing. My dad who died, if he knew that I was talking to you right now. And then Paul McCartney goes, he's listening. And there was just this lightness and otherworldliness of how he's able to open to something. And James Corden started crying. And that's it. And we our job as storytellers is to elicit emotion really deeply. And when we can get into sort of this open, sort of flowing, ephemeral sort of spiritual state, those ideas flow and we're able to elicit motion much more deeply. And so there's a craft to sort of inducing it more often. And if you sort of make those choices, and there's things like meditation or all sorts of different things, but like whatever your sort of process is, to find your own way and to make that really the priority. Like my priority is I get up and I find that flow state, and from that flow state all these other good things happen, as opposed to my job is to write a screenplay or to cross this next milestone or whatever. Those are too concrete and they put you down too sort of earthy. What you really want, if you're being in the creative, a professional creative, to find a way into that floaty, daydreamy state as consistently, as deeply as possible, because that's where your best ideas are going to come.
You know what's funny? Talking about light energy, when I talk to some of these amazing creatives, the ones that are that are at the top of their game, almost all of them had an extremely light energy. They weren't heavy. Then there's very accomplished writers and filmmakers who I've talked to who it seems like they almost grind it out. They almost like by pure force are grabbing and creating amazing things, but it's their own almost their own will that's pushing them. Where someone like a Paul McCartney could just go, "Hey Jude." Okay.
Here's my theory on that. I love that you brought it up. My theory is the grinders are succeeding despite the grind.
Correct.
That it's, the flow is what works for everybody. Some people are able to more easily flow. Other people have to grind it out and haven't learned to sort of soften the grind part. And they're so good and so talented, they're succeeding despite that sort of effort, grinding, hard work, kind of constipated energy. You want to let that thing flow.
And that's the thing. And that's constipated energy is a great word to use, because, you know, and we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but like someone like Spielberg, he has a very light energy to him. And everybody, and I've talked to a ton of people who've worked with him.
Yep.
And I hear stories on air and off air about Mr. Spielberg. And you just go, I understand. I get why he's Steven Spielberg.
I've heard that same exact thing, that it's not that you talk to him and there's at once a normalcy. He's totally normal and totally infatuated with the process at the same time. And that's that sort of light balance. It's amazing.
And
he makes it sustainable. That's why he's able to hit in multiple decades, because he's able to put himself in that flow state so deeply, so consistently, in so many different variables and variations, because it is a shark infested business, right? So it's one thing for you and I to kind of have a cool conversation about flow here, but can I keep that flow going, A, when I'm writing, and B, when I'm on meetings, and C, when I'm in all, you know what I mean? And the more places in your life you can up that volume of that flow state and be in there, the more success you have. And to me, somebody like Spielberg is mastering it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But I think also the thing that stops us from doing that is just the for lack of a better term, the crap that is surrounding us in living life, the crap that Andy Dufresne goes through. Like, literally, it's this heavy shit that's been thrown onto us, and that could be childhood stuff, that could be anger, that can be, you know, envy, that could be ego. All of that is holding us down. But if you can shed it off. That's when you can become lighter and open up to these other areas.
And here's how to help you shift that. Who put that shit on me? Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, "Oh, it was my parents, yes, this or that."
Yeah, yeah.
No. I put it on myself, maybe because my parents were modeling it or whatever happened in my thing. But the powerful thing is, I created that reality as a kid. I created how I responded to that. I'm creating my reality now. So if I have a shitty reality, I have the power to create a little less shitty reality, less shitty, and then mm-hmm. eventually really magical, amazing reality. It's us owning our own perceptual system. I mean, it's got to be based on objective reality, right? There's definitely a consistent reality outside of our subjectivity, but we have a tremendous ability to choose how we respond to objective reality, and that's where that real power comes in our life.
I'll tell you, from my point of view, you know, coming up, I was an angry and bitter guy. Yeah. Because I felt that I wasn't getting that. First of all, in my 20s, I'm like, why hasn't anyone recognized my genius? I mean, obviously, why don't they understand who I am? I mean,
that's right.
Come on. So when you didn't become Steven Spielberg, or our generation, Robert Rodriguez, because he was the one that kind of like, that was the lottery ticket for our generation, no question. So you're like, if we're not Tarantino or Robert or Linklater or Smith or any of the guys that came up in the 90s, we have failed. So when I couldn't get to that place, or for whatever reason, the universe didn't open up those opportunities, I became extremely angry, extremely bitter. And that completely stifles any sort of creativity. It stifles everything. The moment I launched Indie Film Hustle and let go of all that anger and started to give and started to be of service and start,
right.
my right. energy became lighter. Don't get me wrong. I ain't perfect. I'm definitely not Gandhi. But I noticed it, and this is something only us old farts can talk about. As you get older, you start seeing these things. Some people never learn it in a lifetime.
Yeah.
But I started seeing that energy, and then that's when things start. Then I made my first feature, then I made my second feature, then I wrote my books. Then doors that were shut to me all my life, doors that I would have killed to get into, are wide open now. So it's really interesting. And if you look at some of the, and I don't want to get religious, but if you look at some of the spiritual leaders, even some spiritual leaders, like a Gandhi.
Sure.
They are not a heavy energy. there's a very lightness to it. And I don't want to get foo-foo about it, but when we say light energy, it's kind of like this, you feel it when you meet somebody.
Yeah.
People feel like when you meet somebody, you're just like, I got to take a shower, or, oh my God, I want to be around them. Like, I don't know if you've ever been in a room with a movie star before. Mm-hmm. When you meet a movie star who's a real movie star, Not a fallen star, not a star up and coming, a movie star. And when you're in the room with them, you go, oh, I get it. They don't say a word. Yeah. And you just get that energy from them. You're like, oh,
it's that it factor that they talk about. And it absolutely is an energetic thing. They're one way or another able to sort of show up with a certain type of energy that just is different than the way most people can do it. Mm-hmm. And a part of it's there's an authenticity to it and a sort of probably a lack of attachment to it. I mean, there's a qualities of how you sort of facilitate that in yourself. But you're right. They have it. Politicians. I had a friend that met Bill Clinton. He was at some show like at the Met. And he said, man, after he walked on stage and he said he literally had never seen somebody that like literally looked like $1 million. There was just an aura of energy. And he's not like an energy guy, but he was like, that dude had this. And that's the thing. It's like you just. And obviously, if you're president, there's a lot of stuff going on, right? But in terms of like, I mean, that's an easy, but movie stars have it. And what's great about everybody that's listening, it's not anybody can do it. All of us can be, we all are limited by what our own sort of biology
beliefs.
Is. But we can be at the max of our own ability by looking into these in your own way. What sort of spiritual shifts or energetic shifts? So there's things I promise you can do, and the return on that investment. It's so phenomenally better for your joy. And as you do that inside job and make those shifts, everything else gets better. You write better stories. You have better relationships. It all happens, but it's got to start inside first. Like if you don't do that and you win the Oscar and whatever, you still feel miserable. And sometimes you feel even more of a fraud because you haven't got the inside job worked out.
Oh, yeah. I've spoken to people like that, that won an Oscar. And I'm like, so what's it like afterwards? You're like, I feel worse sometimes, you know. It was cool that night, but then afterwards, then what? Then it lasts for a little bit, and then
it's heartbreaking.
You gotta get back up there again. Like, and then it's like this. It's like winning the Super Bowl. Like,
yeah. Well, that was where I was going. One of my favorite stories around this is Phil Jackson's. After the Bulls, I think right when he started coaching the Lakers, he wrote this book called Sacred Hoops. And he talked about when he, as a player, won the NBA championships for the Knicks. And they went to, like, Tavern on the Green, and Robert Redford was there, and Dustin Hoffman was there. And he was like, oh, my whole life was like, man, to win an NBA championship. And I'm here. And he felt empty. Effing felt empty. And he was like, what the hell? And it was because he was, what most people do, he was saying, the outcome defines who I am, as opposed to I'm just a soul that's expressing myself, and my sort of purpose on life is to be happy, is to be in this flow state. And then from there, I'm a great athlete or great this or great whatever. And for him, it was a real threshold moment that he was supposed to be the happiest point in his life, and he wasn't. And it was a big part of his spiritual journey to say, no, it's every day. I show up every day. I chop wood. I carry water. I show up and find my state of happiness in service to people. And I love that story for you is that you found that place from I'm kind of a victim, things are happening to me, to no, I'm going to take ownership in my life. You knew so much about independent film, and you started helping people this way and that way and the other way, and that spiraled you up and up and up and up, and you can see it. Your energy really shines in a way that's different now than it was 10 years ago. It's really awesome.
I appreciate that. I truly appreciate that. And, the one other area that we all go through, we've talked about a little bit, is failure. And we all have had those blocks, those things, you know, things not working out the way you go through. How do you approach failure in the business? Because that script didn't get picked up. They didn't sell that script. I couldn't get the money for the movie. Or that actor dropped out. Or a million things that could have happened. Me, with my shooting for The Mob, I literally got as close as to hanging out with Batman at his house. And I mean, that's as close as you're going to get, literally, other than being on set and then it getting yanked from you. And that threw me in a 2-year depression and all of that kind of stuff. So how do you break through these? Because we all go through it, and it doesn't matter what level you're at. I mean, Spielberg still goes through it. You know, all of them do. Yeah, they go through their own versions of failure, obviously. But how do you get through it?
It's exactly what I just said. It's prioritizing flow state and joy and service above all. Right. Because when we can be, you know, and it's a practice. Right. And I'm really, really good at it. And I still stumble with it. Right. But when my priority is I'm going to show up, and I'm going to find, you know, authentically. You can't just be like BS, you know, head in the clouds, whatever. You have to sort of be in your body and be of spirit, right? It's the balance of those things. And when you can do that legitimately with authenticity, differentiated from outcome, that's when you know you're nailing it. And so the outcome could be deal goes through good or deal goes through bad. You can be, got to be differentiated from either one. Could be a health crisis, relationship crisis, business. It's all the same thing. All those things, you will be happy to the extent those things are secondary to your number one priority is I show up and I'm an open human being and I'm existing and I'm trying to help other people. And that's, again, it takes practice, but anybody listening to this, if this sounds like, oh, you know what, there's some truth in it, find your way to practice, because you can do it. And I promise you, the more you practice this in your own way and own style, the dividends are amazing. And then once you get the inside job shifted, then everything else out in your life, your relationships are going to get better, business is going to get better. You're just not, because you know how it works in Hollywood. So you can't be desperate and you can't be boring, right? You're not going to be boring. You're authentic. And you're not going to be desperate if you differentiate from outcomes. Then you become that cool kid in high school. It's like, oh, okay, all right, everything's fine. Everything's great. And so wherever you are in your journey, if you have this energy of it's perfect the way it is now, it's effing awesome, more good things are coming, and I'm already here, everybody wants to work with that guy. If you're the crankier one, then it gets sketchier.
Yeah, and the that energy of I always joke about the desperation as a cologne. We all can smell it in the business. It's called Desperation by Calvin Klein, and we can smell it a million. And I know it because I used to wear Desperation quite often, especially when I first got to LA. Yeah. And you would meet one producer somewhere on a set, and you'd be on them like white on rice. And you were just like, "What can you do for me? How can you help me? How about blah blah?" And it's the wrong way of approaching it, and it's only afterwards where you just go, when you sit back and you're like, hey, if it works out, great. If it doesn't, it's all good. If you got that kind of energy to it, people want to work with that energy as much more so than somebody's like, me, I can't help, desperation. It's horrible. And I don't know about you. I've only met a couple of desperate screenwriters in life. Not many.
never.
It's just it's rare to meet filmmakers or screenwriters who are desperate. No, I'm joking. I kid who I love, because we all have been there. We've all been that desperate person, and if you can break through that, that's why you see some people make it.
And what's so interesting is screenwriters. Who is a screenwriter? You imagine stuff. You imagine worlds. You imagine things. So screenwriters imagine this beautiful life for yourself. And again, in an authentic way, not in a BS way, but like look at the abundance in your life, the abundance of air, the abundance of like you're going to eat today probably. You're going to have all these. You have friends. There's so much you can frame legitimately. Again, not BS, but like authentically frame your life in abundance no matter what's happening. And when you do that, and using the same muscles that you write screenplays in, you just imagine this grounded, beautiful, blissful life for yourself and frame it that way. There was a way it struck me a couple months ago. I was walking to Trader Joe's with my 14-year-old son. And we were going in there to, you know, run an errand. And I had this really beautiful moment of going, oh, if I was like 10 years or 20 years in the future, thinking back to this moment, it would be so sort of romanticized and lovely. And then I was like, oh, but I can do that now. And so in that moment, totally mundane errand with my son, I romanticized that. And it was so beautiful just to be there as a dad with his son. We did nothing. We picked up some lettuce for lunch or whatever, you know, but it was so beautiful. And that ability for me to go, oh, I can frame my existence in a way that's really beautiful, in the way we might frame a shot as a director, or as the way we frame a scene as a screenwriter. You can frame your own existence. And I'm telling you guys, the more you do that, everything slowly up levels.
And I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
The longest to learn, was that the nowness, you know, that I have the power to celebrate right now.
What did you learn from your biggest failure?
That it was not the failure; it was my response to the failure and how I, what I was talking to myself about, what I said, you know, because I failed, then I'm not good enough or this enough or whatever. And as I got more familiar with that voice and kind of befriended that inner voice, then the failure became a really beautiful lesson. But in the moment that it happened, it didn't feel that way.
And what are three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Oh, your favorite three.
Oh, really?
I hate one of the things at NYU Film School. I had this one instructor that was like, oh, you have to watch this such and such movie. And I was like, you know what? F you. I'm never watching that movie. And it was a movie I would have liked, but I resented that he was telling me I should. So I'm of very much the mindset that whatever you personally want to read or watch, and just the amount that you want to watch it or read it is the ideal amount. So 5 minutes into Netflix, you don't like it, turn it off. 5 minutes into my screenplay, if you're reading it, five pages, you don't like it, put it down. I want you to put it down. I want you guys focus on what you love most by your personal perspective, because to me, that is the most powerful thing you can do for yourself.
And where can people get a hold of you and find out what you're doing?
BrooksElmsCoaching.com is my website for if you want to sort of explore working with me. And there's two main programs that I do. One is helping people develop a script. One is helping people get it sold. And if not me, I've mentors that I because I don't do hourlies. Sometimes people want hourlies, and I have other people that I basically refer them to. Although you are the guy to hire if for any sort of independent film stuff. I mean, guys, I'm telling you, because here's the thing. Let me plug you for a second, because he's got the Amazon of information for independent filmmakers. You've got writing. You've got everything. A lot of it's free. You got premium. You got the whole damn thing. But I'm telling you guys, you don't know what you don't know. So hire Alex for a couple hours and tell them, I think I know this about making my next film, or I think I know this or that. And he will go, yeah, you're right here. This is correct. But this, you're totally off. And you'd rather get that in 1 hour from a master like Alex than go for years to figure it out for yourself and go, God damn it. Alex could have told me that last year, but I didn't figure it out. So hire somebody that knows at whatever budget you can. And I'm telling you, that's going to speed up your game so much.
I appreciate that wholeheartedly for that plug, sir. I could tell you from my experience, coaching could save you. I've literally sometimes I've had someone give me an hour of their time, and they hire me for an hour, and I save them. He's like, you just saved me $50,000. I'm like, because you didn't know. I mean, I know I've walked this path, man. Hire someone who's walked the path. It doesn't have to be me. It could be anybody that you feel comfortable with. But if you an hour or two talking to someone, coaching that could, oh my God, it's obscene what you can learn in an hour and 60 minutes on your story. It could save you 6 months. It could save you $60,000. It could save you so much time talking to someone who's just walked, and they don't have to particularly be a master. They just have to be ahead of where you're at.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It doesn't, you know, because some people will talk themselves out of getting that help because, oh, I haven't heard of anything they've done or this or that or blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't matter. If the guy at Trader Joe's has a good idea to help you with your script or whatever, hire him, dude. Well, whoever can help you move one step forward is great. And we don't know what we don't know. So even if here's what happens, and this is never going to happen, but even if you guys hire Alex and he goes, dude, you got it. Awesome. Yeah, I'm not worried about this. Your idea is great. This is great. And he gives you no other tips other than, dude, you are in great shape. That's like the best money ever spent. You're going to have so much more confidence. It's so great. And of course, that's not going to happen. He's got all sorts of good ideas. But like that feedback loop is really where we make the most progress as quickly as possible. So find some sort of mentor in some sort of way. And that's the fastest way forward for you guys.
Brooks, it has been a pleasure talking to you, my friend. I'm sure we'll have you back on the show in a future date. But thank you so much for all you do for screenwriters and filmmakers. And thanks for being on the show, brother. I appreciate it.
It's completely my honor and my pleasure. Really exciting.
I want to thank Brooks so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Brooks. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to reach out to Brooks, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/143. And we have episode 150 coming up, and I am in search right now for that amazing
heavy hitting guest that we're going to have come on the show for episode 150. So hopefully we get somebody really cool. I'm in the works of getting some really cool guests for the rest of this year, guys. So I want you to keep an eye out for that. Thanks again so much for listening. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.